From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, bombs over Syria, UN appeals on Ebola, climate change. Eric Holder will go, Derek Jeter too. The U.S. and a broad coalition, says the president, striking ISIS and more in Syria, including this U.S. Tomahawk missile launch from the Arabian Gulf. Attorney General Eric Holder stepping down after 6 years on the job. He remembered early days and early hope with the president.
I often think of those early talks between us about our belief that we might help to craft a more perfect union. Now, work remains to be done, but our list of accomplishments is real.
And a roar from the streets, a People's March for Action on Climate Change worldwide and here in New York. Fossil fuels have got to go. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Josh Letterman of the Associated Press, Siobhan Gorman of the Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you on board with this push against ISIS? Thoughts on Eric Holder, on the urgency of climate change, on Jeter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, just back from the UN General Assembly in New York, is Josh Letterman, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Josh, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Siobhan Gorman joins us from Washington, national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, great to have you as well.
Great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Josh, and Siobhan.
Lots of news from all over this week, a lot out of the United Nations. And here we have the American president going through such a laundry list of woes facing the world right now, up and into, he said, the heart of darkness.
As we gather here, an outbreak of Ebola overwhelms public health systems in West Africa and threatens to move rapidly across borders. Russian aggression in Europe recalls the days when large nations trampled small ones in pursuit of territorial ambition. The brutality of terrorists in Syria and Iraq forces us to look into the heart of darkness.
That is quite a list, and there's more. Siobhan Gorman, can we start with the last, the heart of darkness, he says, terrorism in Syria and Iraq. Borders crossed this week, U.S. bombers and more into Syria, drones, Tomahawk missiles. What is the step that's been taken this week in this newly mounting campaign, Siobhan, against the Islamic State, ISIS?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a very offensive step that was taken, going after both ISIS and the Khorasan group, which is a cell of al-Qaeda leaders in Syria. And so essentially Obama opened up a two-front war on different terrorist organizations in Syria, which was a pretty significant step. And notably in the same speech that you were referencing, he also referred to ISIS as the network, a network of death.
Yeah. A network of death. Josh Letterman, how does the White House see this strategy? What is afoot here now? The ground troops that the U.S. is not going to provide, nowhere in sight at the moment in Syria, but a lot of bombing there this week.
That's right. Siobhan mentioned the network of death, which to a lot of people listening to the speech brought up recollections of President Bush's axis of evil. But the White House is really committed and really focused on trying to differentiate this conflict from other conflicts the U.S. has been involved in by really trying to build as broad of a coalition as possible, including, most importantly, other Sunni Arab nations such as Qatar, the UAE, and other nations that are joining in this fight to really make this not seem like something that the U.S. is going off and doing on its own, but really a global response to this threat that really threatens not only the immediate Middle East region, but perhaps the entire world.
The language was arresting. It was very reminiscent of axis of evil talk. The president used the word evil. Of course, it's moderate Syrian rebels, ultimately, that the U.S., with the coalition, wants to support. This was Wednesday. Speaking with NPR, the president of the Syrian Opposition Coalition, Heidi Albara, said he and the rest of the moderate Syrian rebels need international support if they are to take on both Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Islamic extremists, ISIS.
Our force cannot fight two-front war. nor one front against ISIL for a very long time without international support. We were fighting alone with limited ammunition, limited supply of weapon, limited support, and we couldn't sustain the offensive against ISIL and against the regime.
We can't do it all, say the Syrian moderates. Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding this week here?
A dramatic change for the president. I mean, the same president who months ago called arming the Syrian rebels a fantasy now calls it a strategy. The same president who called ISIS the junior varsity, now they're the network of death. The same president who asked Congress to repeal the 2002 and 2003 AUMF, the authorization to use military force, now cites that as his warrant for attacking ISIS in Syria. You know, really not since Jimmy Carter, not since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 made an overnight cold warrior out of Jimmy Carter, not since then has an American president events so changed his settled worldview, and the public has noticed. I mean, the latest public opinion poll, these show that these fundamental shifts in policy and even more persona have only 34% of Americans approving of his foreign policy.
Josh Lederman, is the White House comfortable with this new role? Does the president feel forced into it at knife point, shall we say, by ISIS?
I don't think at knife point. I think the White House is committed to this, but I do think that this is not a conflict that the president had ever sought to be involved in. This was, as Jack was discussing, a president who wanted to end wars in the Middle East and end the heavy U.S. military involvement in long-running conflicts that really, when it comes to it, don't have all that much necessarily to do with the United States or with what the president is trying to do. At the same time, I think once you started seeing televised beheadings of American and other Western hostages by this group, it became a situation where the president felt like there really was not any alternative but to try and address this threat.
The issue before the British Parliament today, by the time listeners you hear this, they may have voted. Expectations that they will vote to join the coalition into Syria or not. We'll see Prime Minister David Cameron picking up on the president's appeal from the UN. Josh, you were up there urging the parliament earlier today to approve plans to join the American-led air campaign against ISIS, saying it poses a direct threat to Britain.
This is not a threat on the far side of the world. Left unchecked, we will face a terrorist caliphate on the shores of the Mediterranean and bordering a NATO member with a declared and proven determination to attack our country and our people.
Siobhan Gorman, the strategy of the bombing in Syria now, again, no one's saying there are boots on the ground ready to follow up on this bombing. What's the point of it exactly right now?
Well, the point of it right now is to sort of arrest the progress of ISIS and to some degree also this Khorasan group, which was believed to be plotting against Europe and also possibly the U.S. It's going after sort of logistics hubs and more recently oil refineries and that infrastructure, which is what ISIS uses basically to fund its organization. And so right now, it's the bombing campaign is kind of going after infrastructure, which will make it difficult for these groups to move forward.
We had the president of Iraq this week, Siobhan, saying that they had discovered a terrorist plot against American subway systems. Was that seen as credible in Washington?
Well, in Washington, I think U.S. officials, both at the White House and in the various agencies that handle national security matters, were caught off guard by that statement. And when they learned about it, really mainly in press reports, they said, well, we're looking into those reports, but they didn't have any such information. And my understanding is that, you know, folks on the U.S. Side believe that if there had been such a plot, particularly against the U.S., U.S. subway systems, they would have picked up on it. So I don't know that they see it as a super credible threat at this point, unless there's more information that's brought to bear.
Josh Lederman, at the United Nations, the American president chairing the Security Council only once before in history, I think that's been done by a U.S. president, asking for nations to pass laws to stop their citizens from heading off to fight with the Islamic State or others in Syria. Does that call, did he get a good response to that? Does it look like steps would be effective in doing that?
Well, he did get a unanimous UN Security Council resolution, as well as the support from a whole lot of other nations. At the same time, not really a resolution that is probably going to have a whole lot of an impact in changing the course of this conflict. They did do it under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, meaning that it can be enforced in certain ways. But basically what this is saying is we really want nations to do what they can to stop foreign fighters from leaving their countries and going to join the fight. But, you know, this isn't the kind of really powerful UN resolution, if there even is such a thing anymore, that is likely to be a real inflection point in the conflict.
I mean, Jack, here we are. You had this week the news of the French mountaineer who was beheaded by a sympathetic group to ISIS in Algeria, North Africa, not even on the scene. What is unfolding here, Jack?
Well, I think we've heard from ISIS. They're saying to the sympathizers all over the world, and they're using the social media to get the message out, strike at anybody. I mean, kill people. In Australia, there was a recent incident. And so they have a vote. And I expect that we're going to see more of this. And the sort of competition and atrocity by groups and by sort of, self-incited jihadis all over the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bombing Syria. Eric Holder, Attorney General, headed out. Climate outcry. Ebola again. Derek Jeter's last home game at Yankee Stadium. Josh Letterman is with us, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Siobhan Gorman, national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty is with us. We've got plenty of callers on the situation in the Middle East. Hassan in Seattle, Washington. Hassan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling from Seattle.
Hi, Tom. Hi, guest. I just quickly want to comment. We'll make a comment that, we've basically become full circle when it comes to our policies in the Middle East for, the last several administrations. I mean, it seems like things are more out of control now than ever before. And we've, kind of taken part in that by supporting the dictatorships, by arming the government. I mean, we're kind of going out of our way to say, look, we have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain on our side, when those are the same countries responsible for this extremist ideology.
So what's your advice, Hassan?
My advice is that we need to do like a thorough review of what exactly we've been doing there, who we've been supporting, leveraging our superpower role. I mean, we are a superpower militarily, but it seems that when it comes to the Middle East, we capitulate to the Saudis, to the Israelis, to the Qataris.
But Hassan, that's sort of starting to become everybody. What's the alternate universe that we would look to after this thorough review?
Well, I mean, look, we would have to, get the Saudis in the room and say, look, you need to do something about this extremist ideology coming out of your country, or no more guns, no more Boeing airplanes, put sanctions on them. I mean, if our bottom line is profit, but look what happened. Sure, our corporations benefit, but look what's happening. Those are American-made weapons in the hands of, ISIS and whatever rebels and terrorist groups.
Hassan, you're sharp, and I really appreciate your call. Siobhan Gorman, what about Saudi Arabia in the middle of this? It's Wahhabi fundamentalism is related, very much related to what we're seeing here. What's the U.S. relationship with this big Gulf, Arabian Peninsula power?
Well, this week it is, a partner in doing the airstrikes in Syria.
And last week?
Well, it speaks to the real complications that the U.S. has in, marshaling allies and kind of staking out a position in the Middle East, because there are lots of shifting allegiances. And, Saudi Arabia has been also a very aggressive proponent of, taking Assad out of power in Syria. And that was really its primary goal over the last several years in prodding the U.S. along to take action in Syria. So
to get him out because he's a bad man or because he's aligned with Iran, their Shia adversary?
Well, it's probably a little bit of both. There's the geopolitical alliances and biases in this region are incredibly complicated. And, you know, for 3 years, the U.S. Was not terribly active except for in some sort of smaller covert ways. And now that we are stepping in, it's going to get even more complicated because a lot of the powers in the region care much more about Assad than the terrorism issue, but obviously with the growth of ISIS, that is a huge factor in everyone's calculations too.
Complications all over the place. Let's go from West Coast to East Coast with another Hassan in Boston. Hassan in Boston, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment is United States and the West are supporting the dictatorship in their place. The example is the Syria. We're supporting the Syria and the entire Arab. When the Egyptian get a freedom, we supported the dictatorship of military. Thanks for taking my call.
Hassan, I appreciate your call. Josh, there is all the complication of getting involved here in Syria, and you cannot do that without getting in the middle of this civil war. Where does the U.S. stand now on Assad? It says it's still, as I said for years, the U.S. wants him out. But what do our actions say, Josh?
Well, the U.S. is really trying to thread the needle in a way that doesn't seem to really work for a lot of observers outside the United States. You know, we still say, as the United States, Assad has to go. He's used these chemical weapons. He has lost legitimacy. That's why we're supporting these moderate opposition rebels. We also say the Islamic State has to go. Of course, the Islamic State is also fighting Assad, and these moderate rebels that we want to support and embolden, their main target is Assad, not the Islamic State, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and these moderate rebels are somewhat aligned with the Islamic State, even if they don't agree with all of their tactics in wanting Assad to go. So the challenge for the United States is to find whether there's this small middle ground that we can strengthen that will both fight Assad and fight the Islamic State and be our boots on the ground while the United States supports them, along with some partners with airstrikes and other means of assistance. Whether that can be done and whether there are enough of these moderate rebels who are truly moderate to do that remains a very big question.
West Coast, East Coast, New York Times editorial board this week saying no convincing plan here on Syria. Let's go to the middle of the country, Paul in Omaha, Nebraska. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Tom. My comments echo those of Hassan in Seattle. I believe that any time Western powers get involved in the Middle East, it only complicates matters between all of the various factions, Shiites, Sunni, and then the different nations. You know, you have Saudi Arabia kind of double dealing over the last few decades between the Wahhabis and the royal family. You know, it's kind of playing both sides of the fence.
But what's your bottom line, Paul? We just stay out and let the Islamic State roll? We what?
My bottom line is that we have flooded the region with enough arms from F-16s to M-16s that they should be able to take the fight themselves. No one knows the intricacies of the politics and the hatreds better than those in the region. It's time for them to take the reins and settle this.
Omaha military poetry from F-16s to M-16s. Jack, we've got to look at Ebola, climate, and Eric Holder, but last word on this front this week, Jack.
Well, it belongs to an Arab diplomat quoted in the hallways of the UN who went to Hassan's point, Hassan Seattle. He said there was a Bahraini plane, maybe more than one, involved in one of these raids over Syria, but it didn't drop its ordnance because, quote, Qatar, I beg your pardon, I don't mean
Qatari,
to...
Qatari, okay.
Qatar,
be clear.
Yes, indeed. Qatar had already paid for that equipment, so it didn't want to bomb it.
You mean the equipment on the ground?
Equipment on the ground belonging to ISIS, which their funding had paid for. That is one of the paradoxes in this, you know, palimpsest of paradoxes that is the Syrian nightmare that we're about to enter.
A palimpsest. You heard it here. We've got a groaning table of news here. Ebola growing and growing and rapidly in Africa. This was just yesterday at the General Assembly at the UN. President Obama telling leaders there bluntly that the world response has to be bigger.
I want us to be clear. We are not moving fast enough.
we are not doing enough. Right now, everybody has the best of intentions, but people are not putting in the kinds of resources that are necessary to put a stop to this epidemic.
Think about what that means. Cover of Business Week this week, Bloomberg Business Week, Ebola is coming. Let's hope not. It has come in small ways. Those Americans who have come back and been treated here, including at the Nebraska Medical Center. Doctor there, American doctor Rick Sacra, became infected with Ebola virus earlier this month in Africa, was released back home in Holden, Massachusetts this week. Here he was.
I would like to request a continued outpouring of prayer and practical help for the people of West Africa. Though my crisis has reached a successful end here, unfortunately, the Ebola crisis continues to spin out of control.
And let's hear straight from, this is Liberia, talking with NPR's Arun Rath on Saturday. This is Jude Moore, the deputy chief of staff to Liberia's president, talking about the impact that Ebola is having on his community. Listen, for we heard Heart of Darkness, now it's hell out there.
It has affected every part of our lives. There's a Liberian handshake, and it means nothing now because nobody ever does that. It's affected how we greet each other, how we grieve. It's altering us as a people and the distinctive things we've come to associate with being Liberian. And that's what I meant when I said it's hell out here.
How we greet each other, how we grieve. The poetry from Liberia that Mike in Berea, Kentucky. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom.
Hi.
Anyone who's actually been to some of these African nations, and I had the opportunity to travel in the military a bit, when this Ebola crisis started, you know, I wasn't panicked, but I was very concerned that it would just steamroll out of control without the response from Western nations. And if we don't put more of our troops, and I'm not a war hawk in the least, but if we don't put troops in Africa to coordinate and create these centers and isolate this population, this epidemic will drag on for the next 5 years, the next decade. Thank you.
Mike, I appreciate your call. One more on the Ebola front. Annapolis, Maryland, Alexandra, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that as a military spouse myself, I agree with the previous caller. We need to get boots on the ground in Africa immediately. I feel that this is spreading at an expedited rate. It's something that will be out of control soon. We have medical staff out there who are short on supplies. They're exhausted. It's so hot. They have to be completely covered from head to toe to protect themselves. They're growing weary day by day. It is an exhausting job, and there's just limited resources, limited personnel. We need to send people immediately, and I'd like to see my country put this on the forefront of our media. I'm tired of hearing about the NFL, and I'm tired about hearing about social issues. Right now, this is the most important thing. It's going to affect our future.
Alexandra, and you're a military spouse. You're a military spouse. This could be your spouse going.
Yes, yes. And we talk about it often. You know, we feel that ISIS is important as well, but that's an issue that the Middle East needs to deal with right now. This issue in Africa is a global issue. It's going to spread very, very quickly, and it needs to be addressed.
Alexandra, we've got it. I appreciate your call. We've got relatives of our staff right here at On Point in military terrain with colleagues headed off to Africa, some of them with mixed feelings about that assignment. Siobhan, what 3,000 is it we're sending? Are they there? What's the U.S. commitment at this point?
It's a pretty hefty commitment, but I think the challenge is that it is going to require months to put in place. And we've seen all of these CDC projections that just suggest that months is a very long time and is going to allow the disease to spread.
I mean, I heard a number today that said the infected number could go to 500,000. And so far, I believe it's killing 70% of those infected. These are huge numbers.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And the interesting thing is that when you talk to officials in national security circles in Washington, they are almost as concerned about Ebola as ISIS these days. I mean, they're obviously very different, but the mass death and the resulting geopolitical instability that comes from something like that is of great concern to U.S. national security as well.
And talk about giant challenges. Here's another one that got a lot of noise and attention this week, and many hope more than that. On Sunday in New York, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon marched with thousands of climate change protesters and told reporters he believes this is maybe the major issue the world is facing.
Climate change is a defining issue of our time, and there is no time to lose. If we do not take action now, we will have to pay much more.
And at the People's Climate March, the people in the streets had a lot to say. Here's one young protester telling reporters, this is it. This is the issue for his generation.
Politicians and businessmen sit around and say that they're going to do something about it, but they still haven't done anything. We need a paradigm shift. We need a different mentality towards changing this world. And I care about my future, my children's future, and humanity. And without it, climate change is just going to destroy us all.
I mean, talk about challenges. Destroy us all. Carrie in Montpelier, Vermont. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I was at the march on Sunday, and I think what really struck all of those of us who were there was the sheer number of people. It really showed us that this is no longer an issue that, you know, we can worry about just by ourselves and, get up in the middle of the night and start worrying about this. This is a shared concern. But I will say that one thing that was lacking at the march was the sense of a common enemy, a common target. And I think that as the climate movement goes forward, we should try to find issues or corporations or politicians that the movement can kind of focus on, because right now it's very diffuse and maybe it needs to be. But I think that issues like Keystone, which really have galvanized the environmental movement, we're just going to need more Keystones, in other words.
Make it specific. Give it an edge. Josh Letterman, this momentum it looked huge on Sunday, but we have all seen it dissipate so many times before. Does this feel different, Josh? Is there policy waiting to come into this space created by public outcry?
I don't think it felt dramatically different, but I think the point that we're all building toward at this point is this big climate treaty that world nations are expected to finalize next year in Paris. This would be hopefully a binding treaty to have nations across the world reduce their emissions. But in order to get a successful treaty, a number of years after a similar treaty in Copenhagen really was not so successful, there's going to need to be a lot of political pressure. So both this rally that we saw and this big climate summit that they had at the UN are aimed at really ramping up pressure, especially on developing nations like China, India, other major polluters who have sometimes been more reluctant to get on board with this, to really get everybody aimed at a really substantial treaty next year.
Don in Lexington, Kentucky. Don, our time is short before the break, but what do you know?
Well, I was at the march, and I was totally impressed with the numbers as I stood at one location for approximately 4 hours and 15 minutes. I heard that it went on for about an hour and 15 more minutes. And the mass
just waiting to move, through the streets of Manhattan.
Yes, I had a sign about mountaintop removal, so I was there both to protest and to watch and witness. And it was a very strategic way to do it, since I got to see everybody as well as got to spread my message. The one thing that was happened that I wanted to share was they had made lots of noise at one point. I think it was 1 o'clock.
Yes.
But suddenly, about 15 minutes later, a wave came up. And from front to back, everybody got silent. And you could hear a pin drop on the streets of New York for miles. It was that quiet. Participants and people on the side of the streets. Of course, there were no cars moving, nothing around us that would cause noise normally, because everything was quiet. The people were quiet.
Don, you take us there. It was a very big thing to see. It was impressive. Is it big enough to change the path of climate change? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, a bizarre breach in Washington, Secret Service embarrassment. Iraq War veteran Omar Gonzalez jumped the White House fence and made his way through the White House front door. He had a knife in hand and a lot more in his car. NBC's Kristen Welker.
Prosecutors called Omar Gonzalez a danger to the president. They said on the night he forced his way into the White House, authorities later found more than 800 rounds of ammunition in his car, along with two hatchets and a machete.
Oh, boy, what a story. Alaska's local CBS TV affiliate in Anchorage got a shock. Reporter Charlo Green presented a story about the controversial medical marijuana group Alaska Cannabis Club. Turns out she owns the Alaska Cannabis Club, and she quit right there on air with an F-bomb.
I, the actual owner of the Alaska Cannabis Club, will be dedicating all of my energy toward fighting for freedom and fairness, which begins with legalizing marijuana here in Alaska. And as for this job, well, not that I have a choice, but I quit.
Okay, Charlo, I guess you're out of there. And Derek Jeter wrapped up his epic career at Yankee Stadium in high style. The legendary shortstop, always amazing, drove in the winning run.
Richardson scores on a base hit by Derek Jeter. Is that unbelievable? Or is that unbelievable?
We're looking at a week in the news. Bombing Syria, Holder headed out, climate outcry, Ebola again. Derek Jeter's last home game there at Yankee Stadium. Josh Letterman is with us from the AP, White House reporter. Siobhan Gorman, national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty is with us. You can join us. One more on climate. Betsy in Litchfield, Connecticut. Betsy, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. For those of us who have been part of the environmental and climate change movement for, in my case, it's decades.
Yeah.
You know, the comment about the dissipation of the, you know, after a march.
We've seen, no, you remember Copenhagen, Betsy, the bitter disappointment. We've seen this time and again, and we're asking, is it stronger, deeper now?
Well, I think that the movement is as strong and deep as ever, but what we don't have in the movement is we don't have the Koch brothers. We don't have Karl Rove gathering $100 million for our cause. We are working people, and we have jobs and families and kids and elderly people to take care of. And, so I don't think it's a matter of dissipation and we just forget about it. I think it's more a matter of we have to take care of business, and we don't have these huge corporate entities backing us up with millions, or in the case of the Koch brothers, they're worth $50 billion with a B, and they have unlimited resources pay salary and staff.
Oh, yeah.
That our movement really, I mean, yes, some people are getting paid, but it's like minimum wage for most people in the environmental movement.
Betsy, look, that was a very impressive turnout globally this week, and a bigger noise than I've ever heard about this personally. But Jack Beatty, you know, among those they're protesting are the most profitable corporations in the world, and Betsy feels that imbalance of power there, trying to make it up this last week with people.
Yes, but, you know, she really is talking there about self-interest. I mean, it's the self-interest of the Kochs to do this. Well, self-interest got a good, on the side of the environment, got a good help this week from two new studies. One from the International Monetary Fund that found that the 20 top carbon emitters would reap economic gains by imposing a heavy carbon tax if they cut income taxes proportionately. And that, of course, is to say you could, you know, the usual argument is if we do something, China won't, and therefore we can't.
Yeah.
Well, this says it's in your economic interest to do it. You get more growth out of it if you tax carbon, cut income taxes. Growth can go up as much as 1% a year, according to this study. And then self-interest for individuals. There's a bill in Congress that effectively it's called, you know, cap and dividend. That essentially would be a way of capping emissions for the big emitters and taxing that and rebating the tax to consumers. Something like the Alaskan plan. It could give, according to some estimates, $2,000 a year to an American who was thrifty about how they use their energy. Think of that. So, in other words, you've got to make climate change safe for self-interest. And I think this week there were some important developments there.
A big push on that front. And big news out of Washington, of course. The Attorney General, very close to President Obama, yesterday at a news conference, here he is, Eric Holder, announcing he will step down after 6 years on the job. He took a moment to reflect.
I have loved the Department of Justice ever since as a young boy. I watched Robert Kennedy prove during the civil rights movement how the department can and must always be a force for that which is right.
And he spoke fondly yesterday of his work on civil rights, especially voters' rights.
Our administration, your administration, has made historic gains in realizing the principles of the founding documents and fought to protect the most sacred of American rights, the right to vote.
Josh Letterman, what does it mean to President Obama, you cover the White House, for this attorney general to be going?
Well, it's really interesting because Eric Holder, I think the president has often looked at him as someone who absorbed the blow of a lot of criticism that really was directed for the president. This was he was really a lightning rod for a lot of the criticism that a lot of people had on the right. And I think that we should all be gearing up for a confirmation battle. This is one of the most contentious positions in the federal government. The big question now, does the president try and push a new nominee through the Senate prior to the election in November? Because as anyone here in Washington or elsewhere watching the polls knows, there's a real possibility that Republicans will take control of the Senate in November. If that does happen, the calculus will change for what kind of a nominee the president can get confirmed. I spoke with some White House officials yesterday who said they're confident that whoever the president picks would be able to make it through confirmation either under a Democratic Senate or under a Republican Senate. But I think that that might be a little bit optimistic. I think his choices will certainly have to be a little bit different if he doesn't have a majority in the Senate come November.
Are there names out there or a mold, a cast of a person, a pool of people being discussed?
Sure, there are definitely names floating around. The current Solicitor General, Verrilli, has been a name that really is floating around there a lot. Also, a lot of talk about Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, and a few other folks who are currently in the administration. I would not be surprised if the president does pick someone that's sort of already in his orbit, a familiar face that he's comfortable with, particularly for the last 2 years of the administration, but we'll just have to see.
Siobhan Gorman, you cover national security. The AG has a lot to do with that front as well. How do you think this attorney general will be remembered?
Well, it's interesting because he started out in 2009 making some pretty controversial pushes for, say, releasing the Office of Legal Counsel memos that outlined the CIA interrogation program. And he was in all kinds of fights with then CIA Director Leon Panetta about that, and he prevailed. But more recently, he has been involved, obviously his agency has been involved in the legal approvals for a number of counterterrorism endeavors that have been pretty controversial, whether it was, firing drones on Americans overseas with Anwar al-Awlaki and some others, or providing legal justifications for warrantless, or not warrantless, but for NSA surveillance, these broad warrants for NSA surveillance programs, and other things of that nature that have certainly created a certain amount of frustration on the left.
Jason in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to quickly say I remember Eric Holder as the attorney general who argued the constitutionality of drone strikes on American citizens without trial. Thank you.
Drone strikes on American citizens. There is a lot in there. There was a lot on race as well. A very frosty relationship with many in Congress, of course. Back in 2009, his controversial comment about this being a nation of cowards when it comes to really confronting racial issues. Here was Holder then.
Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as a ethnic melting pot, in things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards.
If you think about it, there are many things to be confronted. You can see what he means. That did not go down well, even up onto this week. People still kicking back on that. Thursday during Fox News' Kelly File show, Republican Representative Daryl Issa, California, said Holder's done a poor job.
This attorney general has chosen to politicize his office. He's selectively gone after an awful lot of lawful citizens. And he's, just simply not done his job well.
Jack Beatty, Eric Holder on civil rights, on voting rights, on Wall Street.
Wall Street, a bad record, it seems to me. To quote the New York Times, he did not prosecute a single prominent banker or firm in connection with the subprime mortgage crisis that nearly destroyed the economy. These are not accomplishments, quote, to be proud of. This, after the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, in its report, used the word fraud or variance of it 157 times to describe what had gone on in Wall Street before the implosion. And the Attorney General, in a famous statement before Congress, said it's difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if you do, that if you bring a criminal charge, it'll have a negative impact on the national economy. Well, a federal judge, Jed Rakoff, writing in the New York Review of Books, said, to a federal judge who takes an oath to apply the law equally to rich and poor, this excuse, sometimes labeled too big to jail, is disturbing, frankly, in what it says about the department's apparent disregard for equality under the law.
And really, in some ways, no bigger issue during this president's term, during these 6 years that this attorney general's been in office. A distant echo of that, Eric Holder himself was, of course, in Ferguson, Missouri not long ago, kind of standing in for the president there. There was so much anger there, not least because when Michael Brown was shot, his body lay in the street for hours and hours. The Ferguson police chief, Thomas Jackson, issued a public apology by video addressed directly to the Brown family about the handling of Michael Brown's death.
I want to say this to the Brown family. No one who has not experienced the loss of a child can understand what you're feeling. I'm truly sorry for the loss of your son. I'm also sorry that it took so long to remove Michael from the street. The time that it took involved very important work on the part of investigators who were trying to collect evidence and gain a true picture of what happened that day. But it was just too long, and I'm truly sorry for that.
An apology, an explanation, an apology. But in Ferguson last night, the sound of more protests.
These killer cops have got to go.
And that incredible video and sound this week from South Carolina, when police Lance Corporal Sean Grubert, South Carolina state trooper, was arrested and charged with assault and battery for shooting an unarmed man at a gas station. The man, LeVar Jones, pulled over, stopped. Or I guess he was not wearing his seatbelt. Got out of the car. Policeman asked him for his license. Didn't have it in his pocket. Reached into the car for it and was then shot. Shot in the hip, he lived. Bunch of shots here. The whole incident was caught on video. A warning here, this sound here is pretty violent.
Have your license, please.
Get out of the car! Get out of the car! Get on the ground! Get on the ground!
I just got my license. You can't get my license. I grabbed my license right here. That's my license right there.
Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back. Put your hands behind your back.
All those shots, and you hear the man on the ground, I just got my license. You said, get my license. I grabbed my license. It's right here. That's my license. It's right there. Siobhan Gorman, this was difficult to watch. It is difficult to hear. We have not somehow, I mean, I don't know how you get perfect balance here, but we're seeing all these videos. There's talk of more police cameras to be out there, videos and sound of things just not going right in the law enforcement front.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how one incident sort of begets at least recordings of additional incidents, and one wonders whether we are hearing more of these incidences reported because people feel more capable or comfortable bringing them forward, or whether there are more incidents. But it's obviously a disturbing trend that we're seeing.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine Eric Holder sitting back this week with the rest of us? I'm sure he has watched this at the end of his tenure as Attorney General, watching this in America. And I know it's confusing. I know the policeman, I'm sure he didn't know what is the guy getting from his car, but the, you know, in the video at least, it seems like casual ease with which all those shots start raining down. Eric Holder watching that in this week, Jack?
Oh, yes. Eric Holder, who says that when he was with the Justice Department, I think in the late 80s, he was running to a movie in Georgetown, running across the street and was grabbed by with a suit and tie on and grabbed by a policeman. Where are you going? And, you know, he said, I was running while black. This man was driving while black. We just can't escape the racial valence of these incidents. And one answer, a long one, is to integrate police forces up and down so that they genuinely represent the communities that they serve.
Jack, would you take us to one other location this week? And I hope a happier one. The challenges have been many and large. Take us to Yankee Stadium and Derek Jeter, captain of the Yankees, retiring. He'll have another appearance in Boston, but in Yankee Stadium, he's finished.
He's finished, and he how does he end? But with by knocking in the winning run in the game, just amazing. You know, to me, he stands out for two moments. One, the 1999 All-Star game where Ted Williams was wheeled in, 81 years old, very frail. The very first player who shook his hand and held it was Derek Jeter, and who showed such deference and tenderness toward Ted. I'll never forget it. And the second was the greatest play I've ever seen in baseball.
Describe it for us, Jack.
This was in the 2001 Game 3 of the American League Division Series, Yankees versus A's. A's player, a slow runner on first. A ball gets hit into right field. The right fielder throws the ball past the first cutoff man, who's the second baseman, past the second cutoff man, who's the first baseman, and out of nowhere comes Derek Jeter, the shortstop, on the first baseline to grab the ball and in almost the same single motion flip it the way a quarterback would lateral the ball to the catcher, who tags the runner out. That would have been the winning run. Players said that was a shortstop making that play behind first base, then flipping the ball. Said one of the A's players, "It's unheard of." That was Derek Jeter.
Jack Beatty, you should call baseball. I can see you up there at the microphone. I can see you calling it the green diamond and the lights on at night and Jack Beatty on the call. So long, Derek Jeter. That was an incredible, incredible career. Josh Letterman, thank you very much for being with us today. White House reporter for the Associated Press. Great to have you, Josh. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Siobhan Gorman, national security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, you're terrific. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
And Jack, oh boy, you're going to be walking out of the cornfields and all that stuff. If you build it, they will come. If you call Jack Beatty, he will call the game. Thanks, Jack. Have a great weekend.
All right, bye.
Go, Jeter. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.